Yes, Virginia, there is life after TV news, or in this case, TV weather. Eileen Lone has been a meteorologist for decades. She will just not say how long. She's worked in the Cedar Rapids and Waterloo, Iowa areas for a number of years, and she knows what it's like when a picnic gets rained on or hay is down and it's rained on. But you said there wasn't going to be any rain. You ruined me. It's not the first time she's heard it. We'll ask Eileen about that, what it's like to take those phone calls, and how difficult it is to forecast weather for a specific place and time and all the science that goes into that. So this is a discussion that is kind of fun to listen to. But Eileen has more than just TV weather in her background. She also has the production of food and specifically helping those in the next generation learn how to do it. We're going to talk about life after news and weather and how the two have interceded as she teaches and works with students about maybe community gardens or gardens in their own homes. All kind of fun. In this installment of the M2M podcast, I'm Paul Yeager. Thank you so very much for listening. Share with a friend. Tell them I listen to that podcast. It's kind of fun. Thank you. And here is Eileen Lone. How many times did you ruin somebody's picnic or baling hay or family reunion or whatever it was?
Lots and lots. Pretty much every month of every year, I'm sure. Yeah.
That phone you hoped was always with a good weather tip, but unfortunately somebody was always kind of looking for their personal weather forecast, weren't they?
They were. And a lot of the times they'd call when we were really busy. So there's no way we could even answer the phone, and we get the messages. It's like, well, what's it going to be like on my daughter's wedding in October? And this was in May. So there's no way we could tell you that.
But yeah, but I thought you had a crystal ball.
Well, we do, but we're not allowed to let anybody know that. So we had to sign a contract.
One of the joys of Ag Twitter is always the, all right, well, I put my hay down, it should rain.
Yep. We always got the phone calls. It's like, when is we going to have a 3-day, 4-day stretch that I can get the hay down? Yep, exactly.
That was just part of being weather in the Midwest, though.
I think so. Yeah. It's going to be tricky no matter what. This year it's been very tricky. I'm kind of glad I'm no longer doing it day to day, because it would be very difficult to, I mean, it's easy to do the hay because it's been dry, but it's not really growing very fast. So that's going to be our issue there.
No. How many years were you there at KWWL?
A total of, I believe it's 16 total.
Okay.
I've been broadcasting for
20 some years.
Yeah.
Well, let's just pretend we don't have numbers that start with 2.
There you go. Yeah.
Approaching that mid to 2 or 3. The part of weather that was exciting for you was what?
The difference every day. It was trying to, I guess, outguess Mother Nature. It was trying to figure out, what is that temperature going to be? What is that storm going to be? When is it coming through? Are we going to have this dry period? And how is it going to affect everybody? I liked that it wasn't the same. So it was different every day. The hard part was trying, though, to pin down when that storm was coming through, especially for events that were going on or the guys doing hay. It's going to be hard to tell them, yes, you're going to have that window that you need 3 days of window of dry. It's very difficult, as we know, to get 3 dry days, especially in June and July.
And you had a forecast area that was several, you were more of that skinny narrow than the more round area.
Right.
So I know that the chief at your former station, you know, he would always be, well, in our northern counties and our southern counties, and there's a whole lot of difference between those two.
Right. Yeah. East-west forecasting, it's relatively easy because things go from west to east normally. But when we have the north-south stretch, I think when I started, it was 30-some counties, and then when I left, it was 20-some counties. But it's still a lot of difference between, and it could be a 10, 15, 20 degree difference between the north counties and the southern counties, because it went from the Minnesota border almost, I think, 2 counties in from the Missouri border. So it was a change, really, no matter what you tried to do. And sometimes you'd say, well, there's a chance of rain. And yeah, it rains in Iowa City, but it doesn't rain up in Waterloo, or vice versa. And then people think we're wrong.
Don't even say Waterloo, say Cedar Rapids. There'd be times where it would rain in Iowa City and not Cedar Rapids, and that's 20 miles.
Yeah, exactly. And even this year, it's been kind of weird because I do a lot of stuff in Vinton. I live in Urbana, and that's 10 miles, 11 miles driving. I'm not even sure what it is as the crow flies. And there can be a huge difference even with that. It's like, hey, did you get that 2 inches of rain? It's like, no, oh, got like 3 drops. That's it. Yeah. So it's been a big difference no matter where you go.
Is there a reason for that? Why things can be so isolated on one end of town and not the other? Is there a meteorological reason for that?
No, it's actually just physics. As the rain comes through, you've got to where it's raining and where it's not raining, and that edge has to go through somewhere. And sometimes right now, a lot of what gets reported, it depends on where you are. And since towns themselves are starting to grow, there's more people within that boundary. So the boundaries are actually going out. So where we used to get reports only here, now we're getting reports out here where historically there wasn't that many people living. So there may have been rain there before, but now they're not. So really a lot of it has to do with luck as to whether you're sitting at the moment. And is it like, oh, I see that 5 inches of rain, or I get that two drops here and there just down the road. So it really just depends on the luck of the draw of where you're living at the time. And nowadays, all these towns and cities and stuff are just growing, so there's more people to report whatever event is going on.
Is there any truth of the whole, it is a lot more pavement, so it's a lot hotter, or it's, where's that farm field to draw the moisture? I mean, is there any science behind disappearing fields?
There is science behind it, but the problem comes with if you try to use that to say absolutely something's happening, it's hard to do that definitively because 300 years ago, there was not a thermometer there in that spot. Now there is. So can we say that 300 years ago, it was exactly the same, or it's been warming, or it's been cooling? It's very difficult to prove that because not only was the thermometer not there 300 years ago, but 300 years ago, thermometers were a completely different design. So in science, you want to be exact, and it's very difficult to be exact when you say that. But it's there is the heat island effect, which is that concrete and pavement does tend to keep and hold heat. So it does tend to make cities warmer than it does the farm fields. And since there are more cities now, that creep does tend to go out, but it's hard to prove that it's affecting a large enough area to cause issues. But there is that localized effect, I guess you could say.
When you were asked to speak at events, and that's what news folks are usually allowed or asked to do, you'll go speak to the Centerpoint Lions or the Dundee Kiwanis or something. Are they asking you about climate change and things like that?
We do get that. Sometimes it's a lot of why is it raining more, or does it appear to be raining more, or why there are more storms reporting? And a lot of it has to do with the fact that there are more people now. The population of the world is larger. The other part is, technically, there's always been climate change because we used to be under icebergs. We used to be under glaciers. So we've had warming going on. It's been globally warming for 10,000 years. So it's very hard to say that, yes, we've got climate change. But yes, technically, yes, we have climate change. The hard part is proving how much of an effect that humans have on it. I'm sure there's one, but it's hard to prove to that scientific point that, yes, we are doing this much damage to it, or we're affecting it that much faster, because we were under like up 2 miles of ice to 10,000 years ago.
And I'm sure you'd get those questions, and it's always kind of a fun debate, and it might depend on where you're at. And, you know, there's people who will say, it's pretty arrogant of us to think that we have changed the world and its climate, you know, and I can totally see that. And I can also see the part of, you know what, whenever I see a classic car go down the road, I go,
Oh, that smells. Mm-hmm. I smell that. That's what it used to smell like. And yeah. And it's the whole butter margarine thing of, you know, butter was bad and then margarine was bad. And then we realized, you know, margarine maybe not as good because it's got all of that stuff in it. And I mean, the same can be said about, you know, emissions. We might think that one emission was super bad. This emission that we've changed it to, we don't know yet. We just don't smell it. So therefore, it's not a problem.
And that's the problem with people insisting absolutely that this was this 1 inch or 1 degree temperature rise was absolutely caused only by man. May have partially been caused by man. However, it's also caused by volcanic eruptions, by other things that go on, like wildfires that are caused by lightning strikes and not just man-made fires. So it's very difficult to pin down exactly what percentage is caused by man, what is by nature, what would have happened anyway, because obviously 10,000 years ago, there weren't that many people around and it wasn't the Industrial Revolution. So we didn't have the coal burning factories to cause that glacial melting. So it's a little bit of everything, I think.
That we know of. There could have been some massive pollution factory.
Maybe it was those mastodons. Mastodons had their ivory tusk factories. Yeah, you never know.
So the weather is always interesting, and I know that's not your main vocation, but and it's not mine, and I get accused of all you talk about is the weather, Paul. But you know, that's it's a good opening line for a conversation. Eileen got it wrong again, you know, and your name was always used, and I'd always defended knowing meteorologists at television stations, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different stations, and the chiefs and the other meteorologists on staff, the amount of work that goes into trying to predict a forecast with help from National Weather Service and whatever model that you look at and trying to form all of those things. I mean, science is such a huge part of that, but sometimes just things don't work out the way the forecast is. And sometimes you're kind of caught off guard.
Yeah. And a lot of the times I guess what you could say is what we're trying to do is forecast for this point in essentially a liquid atmosphere, because it's a fluid atmosphere that's 12 miles deep and who knows how many, I mean, hundreds of miles, thousands of miles wide. And so we're trying to forecast for one little point in that, and it makes it hard to get it exactly right every single time because it is a fluid. So if you take a bottle of water. So you take a bottle of water and you're trying to forecast what it's going to do here, but all of a sudden you're shaking this bottle of water. Well, obviously that's not necessarily going to be easy to predict exactly what's going to happen there. Now, this is constrained by the frame of the bottle. However, the atmosphere is not. So we've got all sorts of different things that can affect it. As a storm blows up and then drops its rain, it actually puts out boundaries. And where those boundaries go, maybe it'll form another thunderstorm, maybe it won't. So we have to figure out, essentially, once again, it's guessing, but it's education guessing. And a lot of experience goes into that too. So I've had a lot of practice and been wrong a lot of the times, but I've been right some of the times too. So that makes me feel good when I get it right.
I sure wish I could be wrong half the time in my job and still keep it. You know, I love that one. And I was come on. Now that's just...
How about this one, Paul? So the Farmer's Almanac, everybody looks at the Farmer's Almanac, right? So if we can be wrong 50% of the time, I went through the Farmer's Almanac one year when I was at WMT in the 90s. And one year I went through it, I gave it the benefit of the doubt. And yes, it forecast for a large area and it was only right for that year, 23%. So I was right more than it was. So I was happy about that part.
230 is above the Mendoza line. So you'd be able to keep your job in the majors. I think it's 220 is that. So that's that's a good batting average. In August, we had this storm. It was real humid. You could kind of feel something wasn't right. And I was picking up my oldest and talking to my brother-in-law at the time. And I said, well, you know, there's supposed to be some thunderstorms, but the three stations are disagreeing on the timing and the severity. And then all of a sudden I get this, oh, we got a severe thunderstorm watch. And then it's a warning and the sirens go off and this derecho blasts through.
Right.
I'd heard of it. I know you've heard of it, but pretty much I think we were alone. They're a rare storm. I mean, they just don't happen that often.
Why not? It has to have the right situation or right conditions in order to continue to go on. A derecho itself is defined as a thunderstorm, a line of thunderstorms with damaging winds or severe winds for 250 miles or more in length. So it has to reach that 250 mile threshold before it even becomes a derecho. It can still cause a lot of damage before that 250 mile threshold is met. 58 mile an hour winds is what causes damage. That's what a severe thunderstorm warning is issued for one of the criteria. And so 58 miles an hour can create damage, but derechos tend to have the 70 mile an hour or greater because they're lasting so long. They tend to give themselves, at least at parts of it, a feedback loop. So like the rain brings down some cooler air, lifts the warm air and vice versa. And it just continues to feed itself and feed itself. And that's why it can continue to move on and on and on and continue to grow and track its way through the area. And it tends to speed up. So the storms themselves, at least in this case, were moving 70, 75 miles an hour, just move forward motion. So any gusts coming out of it are going to create some damage. They're very hard to predict that it's actually going to happen because of the fact that at any moment it could just stop that feedback loop and just kill itself off. So it has to get to a certain point where before it's like, well, okay, it's definitely going to be speeding up. They're going to issue severe thunderstorm warnings. They may not use that derecho word until after it hits a certain point. And they have gotten better at guessing that, okay, the situation is getting better for the potential for a derecho formation. So the last couple of years, they've had some warnings that have been out, or at least discussions that have been out for the potential for these storms that could produce derechos or long-lived thunderstorm lines of thunderstorms. And it really depends on where they go and the situation. Now we had, as you mentioned, the hot, humid weather. You could tell it was going to be hot and humid. And once the storm gets going, sometimes it just feeds on that moisture and just keeps going because that's their fuel. That's their gas that they use to keep themselves alive. You know, they have to hit a more stable atmosphere, and it just didn't happen until it hit, I believe, Ohio. So it had plenty of fuel and plenty of room to go.
It's just fascinating to see how all of that works and how that develops and continues on and creates massive challenges. You've been on the air for hours at a time during a thunderstorm.
Yeah.
Winter storms, which one's easier to do or which one's more of a challenge?
I think winter storms are longer, but they're easier because you can see them coming a little bit more in advance, whereas thunderstorms, severe thunderstorms, and especially tornadoes, they're harder to pinpoint, and it's a little more urgency, I think you can say, because like winter storms, you know, they put out the warnings or the watches. They could put out a watch a day in advance, whereas thunderstorms and tornado warnings, they usually issue an hour or so in advance, which is a great improvement from when I even started, because they used to issue them maybe 20 minutes before maybe the severe weather would occur. So it's gotten better.
And that's before we had smartphones. Now we can alert each other via Twitter or something that, hey, this is happening.
Right.
And I'm not a meteorologist, but it's happening, friends in Cedar Rapids. You know, there's that discussion too.
Yeah, and I think that helps for the most part because it does give people a heads up. Nowadays, everybody's so busy with events or kids' events that they're taking them to that they're really not sitting in front of the television or having the radio on necessarily when they need that alert. And sirens go off outdoors, and a lot of people say, well, I didn't hear it when I was in my house. They're not supposed to be heard in the house. They're supposed to be heard when you're at those events and to tell you to get inside to safety. And that's when you go inside and turn on the TV or turn on your phone or turn on the radio and get that alert. But nowadays with the phones, it's nice, especially with that WEA, wireless emergency alert, that it'll automatically go off for these especially large events with the 70 plus mile an hour gusts or particularly large tornado emergencies that they expect to cause some widespread damage.
And that travels with me, right? So if I'm in an area I'm not familiar with, if I've gone 100 miles from home and I don't know what the, oh, those clouds, no, that's fine, right? So it kind of tracks me too, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I've taken my phone when my mother-in-law was living down in Kansas, and it will alert me when there's a warning in the area I'm at. And it'll say the county, but it also alerts me because I don't know what county I'm in necessarily, especially if I'm traveling between. But it will tell me, it's like, there is a warning in your area. So that's very nice today with the technology. Whereas before, if you're just driving along and you just had the radio on, it says it's a alert for Dallas County. Well, mm-hmm. I'm from Indiana. I don't know where Dallas County is.
Right. And we'll go back to the original forecasting north to south. If I hear the emergency alert tone go off, but it's for a county 100 miles south of my listening area, I'm really going to be thrown off because it looks sunny and fine where I'm at. I want to get to La Nina, El Nino before we get into what you're doing now. How much do you subscribe to the Pacific winds and looking at if one is developing over the other?
I don't look at them like every day type of thing. I'll just keep pay attention because one affects Midwest more than the other. And I obviously can never remember until I start looking at them. And I believe it's La Nina affects us more than El Nino. And it's usually in the winter months. And it is an effect. It does push the patterns north or south, depending on whether the waters are cooling, which is La Nina, or warming, which is El Nino. And it will change the weather pattern. And especially in farming, it's more important because it will affect Brazil a lot more than it would necessarily affect Iowa. Like, I think El Nino and La Nina both affect Brazil, whereas Iowa is more affected by La Ninas, and California would be affected by El Ninos. So it really affects more in the agriculture than it does my forecasting. Mm-hmm. My forecasting is made easier by one or the other because it makes it if it's a strong one, because it tends to make it a little easier to say, yes, it's going to be dry or it's going to be wet. If it's one of those mild ones, then it's pretty much a normal year, I guess you could say. And it's flip a coin. There we go.
Well, there is no such thing as normal anymore, it seems, this when it comes true. To the weather. And right true. Now, La Nina is the one that's gaining attention in the agriculture right. communities. We're saying, hey, look out, this is coming. Keep as much grain as you can because you're going to be able to sell it is one thing I read just this morning from a guy who follows the weather when it comes to commodities. And, you know, that's also something I guess I didn't realize. I mean, I always knew on the farm that the weather was, but now you have these large agriculture companies that right. have their own meteorology staffs to help forecast La Ninas and El Ninos and right. dry patterns and wet patterns and or lease services that they contract with.
And it's worldwide is what they're looking at patterns, yep. not just like I'm looking at whatever counties I'm warning for. In South Dakota, we warned for the whole state of South Dakota, and like it was 117 counties. It was including little parts of Iowa, Minnesota, and Nebraska, as well as all of South Dakota. Iowa is smaller, but yeah, it's north and south, and you still have that different. But when you're dealing with the commodities or the GTNs or the other large commodity forecasters, they are looking at worldwide patterns. And it's even harder, I think, for them because they have to work more in generalities. I have to do the specific space. And I'm concerned with, okay, what's it going to be like in Cedar Rapids or Waterloo or Waukon mm-hmm. or Lansing or down in Iowa City or Washington? But the commodities guys, okay, what's it doing in Brazil, California, China, as well as over in, I think India is becoming a larger market in some things. And it just depends on where you are and what your commodity is. And anything could affect that. They've been having a lot of heat waves over in Europe. That's going to affect maybe the wine crop, the grape crop, and maybe the olives. So that would affect maybe some of our commodities, not necessarily the grains, but it would affect some of maybe California's crops. And Iowa's now into that wine market as well. So it could affect some of their prices, even though it's different wines. But yeah.
Yeah. In the Sonoma Valley, they're saying we might have some heavily damaged grapes because of the smoke Therefore, right? We don't have a crop, and that's a white wine. And so if you grow white grapes right now, you're going, hey, we might have ourselves a window at some point. So yeah, I mean, that is paying attention. I read if Russia is dry, is it Ukraine or is it Russia? And is it monsoon season? And is it rainy to cause this problem with the Three Gorges Dam in China? You know, what's the major rain? And you're wondering, oh, well, that's going to create this need. So yeah, huge demands on the weather. And as long as our friend Jeff Ryan in Osage gets at his personal forecast, because I know he's called you because he and I have talked about this.
Yes.
He'll be fine. How many times did Jeff call for a personal forecast?
Lots, and he has my email address. So he still emails me and texts me. So
and he's going to email you after listening to this, because I don't know if sure I told will. Him we were going to do this or not, but I think I said we were possibly going to have a conversation. So
okay.
That's good to know. Jeff's a friend of the podcast here. Eileen, what are you doing now? Because they don't see you on TV like they did, but they certainly see you in the community where you're living.
Yes, I live in Urbana. I run the Urbana Farmers Market, which I have for several years. I'm also running, I'm a coordinator for a youth garden over in Benton, which started as some flooded properties from 2008. The city bought the property, and it's a cooperation between the extension, the city, and a bunch of other groups, master gardeners included. And we got some kids together. First year we had three kids. A couple years ago we had like 30 kids. I'm not sure how many we have this year. This year's a little different because of COVID, so it's been kind of weird. But it's been good because the kids decide what they want to plant. They plant it, they take care of it, they harvest it, they get to eat it. And it's really helping them learn where food is coming from. I'm also on the farm to school board at the Vinton Shellsburg School, where 2 years ago, the school was fortunate to receive a USDA planning grant to improve the farm to school access to local foods. And this year we just got an implementation grant, which expands that to include Waverly Shell Rock schools as well as Union schools. So we're trying to increase, and one of my hopes, I'm crossing my fingers, is to try to get a food hub getting located in Vinton to help spread out where that local food, give the producers some place to bring the food and then have it able to go to the schools or whoever needs it. And then also Old School Produce was an urban garden for retail shop in store garden in Vinton, and it became a nonprofit this year, and it's become a giving garden. So we've been producing food, grown vegetables for area food pantries, which included 9 last year in Benton County and even into Iowa County this year. So it's been kind of been very successful, a lot of hard work, but very successful.
I should say for our non-Iowa listeners, this is all areas between, say, Waterloo and Cedar Rapids, so the eastern part of Iowa. And these are rural areas, not where we think one person every mile, but you're in areas that are not more, I'm trying to think, Vinton maybe has 3,000 people.
If at best 3,500, I'm not sure that they have 3,500.
So we have discussed it on our show about access to fresh foods and food deserts, because I don't think there's a major grocery. I know there's one major grocery store chain in one of those towns, but not every town has that. And in the non-mainline grocery stores, that fresh produce is expensive, and that'll eat into a budget. Why did this all kind of come together in the region where you're at?
You know what? It's been a little bit of this and that, because one thing led to another thing. And the more you learn, I think what it is Benton County, which is where I live and where these towns are located, is a relatively poor county, despite the fact that we're between Cedar Rapids and Waterloo, which have more affluent sections of town, sections of population. But Benton County is a relatively, I guess, say poor. It's middle to low class, low income. There are some higher income pockets, but for the most part, there is food insecure people all over the county, really all over the state. But it's been coming to my attention more and more, especially once I got into the farm to school program, that there's a lot of people who don't have access to that fresh produce. Some of it's through the farmers market. We can get them some from fresh produce. Some of it's through trying to get this garden going in the Giving Garden and get that fresh produce to the pantries. What we do find out as well is a lot of the people through the food pantries, yes, they want the fresh produce, but some of it, they don't know how to make it. So we have to get an education component in that as well. So it's a lot of work, but fortunately, it seems to be pretty well received.
Can everybody grow a tomato?
Everybody can. It might take some adjustment to the soil that you have, because it doesn't like clay soil and it likes some warm temperatures. So this year's been kind of a trick because it was so cool to begin with. And it got warm and then it had to freeze and then it got warm and then it got hot and dry. So I think if anybody started gardening this year and failed, don't lose hope. Try it again next year, because this has just been a strange year all in all. Just forget COVID. It's just been a strange year weather-wise even.
So I guess the bigger question is, do you find in these programs that it's better if people grow food at their own areas and bring in excess to some of these places? Or are you finding it's better to have that one community place where people are together in working on a larger garden?
I think it's a combination of both. I think you're going to have the people who like to do it by themselves, because there are some people who just don't like to have the group like around the community garden. Because some people, they grew up, this is how I grow this tomato. This is how I put it in this pot or planted it in the ground. And some people are like, yeah, I'll just plot it here and see what happens. And they're not necessarily going to work together well. So I think it's a combination of a lot of different things. I have found with the youth garden that we've got some kids, the first year we had it, we had like three kids. And by the third year, none of them were there, partially because we're dealing with the mostly elementary and middle school. Well, then they start getting into after school activities. And it hurt my feelings at first, but then I realized that I was told that they have gardens of their own at home. And it's like, boom. That's exactly what we want to happen, is we start it with the community garden so that they can see that they can do it, and then they can do it themselves at home, and then they can share it with their family and maybe their cousins or their friends as well and say, oh, I could do that as well.
What's something I could grow or anybody could grow in one of these gardens that has a good long shelf life, a good nutrition, and that's relatively easy to grow? Is there a perfect
potatoes?
Produce?
Potatoes are really easy to grow. Now, maybe not necessarily the perfect protein or anything nutritional value, but it's got a lot of starch. It's going to be filling. You can do a lot with it. You can fry it. You can bake it. You can put it in soups. So, and it does have a long shelf life. So potatoes, you pretty much plant it and you let it go. Garlic is relatively easy to grow as well. It's not necessarily something that's going to fill you up, but it is going to season those potatoes. Onions also are fairly easy. Carrots are easy. This year was kind of weird on the carrots, though. Most of the carrots, since it was so dry, grew more than one little, they had like legs on them. So they grew multiple roots, I guess you could say. So they look kind of weird. They still taste good, but they look kind of weird. So the kids are not necessarily going to say, that's not a carrot. Beets get a little tricky. A lot of the cold crops, like the early season or the late season, they're going to be more tricky for people just starting out, because they do tend to bolt and go bad fast if it's too warm. So I'd say potatoes are probably one of the easiest, or a vining plant, because you just plop that in and they'll grow pretty easily. Especially zucchini. You'll have plenty of zucchini to give to your friends.
That's always one of the worst. I mean, best gifts that you can give to a friend is zucchini. Here's another cucumber and another zucchini and a squash.
I actually learned early on, I never grow zucchini, partially because I don't have a big lawn and partially because I run a farmer's market. So I could get plenty at the farmer's market. Yeah,
because it is plentiful. And I rotate my tomatoes with peppers. I feel, I've got the jalapenos and the bell peppers, and I can freeze the bell pepper. The tomato is a lot more work to get it canned than say just chopping up a pepper. But I know they both have nutrition. A lot of people grow tomatoes, and
I have a pot going right now. Some sauce on the stove right now.
Oh, okay. So a homemade. You really did go all out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Last thing before I let you go. So I guess I've asked you your favorite or one of the things that we could grow, but food insecurity is going to be a challenge going forward. And it's hard to see in these rural areas where there's this huge abundance of food. And so the last discussion point is 2020 COVID pandemic has questioned how we get the supply of some of these foods. Are we all going to have to start growing more of our food? Is that something you think we're all going to need to do? And I don't mean need.
I don't think all of us need to. I think maybe as a community we need to, but I don't think every individual person needs to. I think we'll need to really look out for each other and make sure that everybody has access to it. Now, some people are not going to want to eat that tomato because some people don't like a tomato. They don't want that fresh produce because they like the prepackaged. But at some point, I think as long as everybody is either growing their own or has access to a garden where they can get their own, whether it's your neighbors growing extra stuff, because as you know, zucchini, there's plenty of extras. Tomatoes, there's almost always extras because it's like, oh, I can fit one more tomato plant in here. No problem. And then you have so many tomatoes. So as long as there's, I think, access for everybody, that is going to be the key here. And not just access, but that people know how to get that. So, you know, they may, like somebody living in an apartment doesn't have room for a garden. Maybe they can put a pot on a patio, but maybe they don't have the right lighting for a tomato plant. So they need to be able to know where they can get that fresh produce.
Yeah, you think of if you could ever have a plot of land next to a big apartment complex, that could be a pretty popular thing. And maybe make a good case for, but just land is so hard to come by in some of those places.
Right.
And it's developed. And so it is ideal, but it's not practical.
Not practical. Yeah. So, but if you can have maybe access, whether it's an actual garden or like a church garden, lots of churches have properties. So maybe they can put a garden on it. A lot of them have been doing that around, even around here. And then they make that available to either their parishioners or people in the community, mostly people in the community who they know or feel that need it. And it's a lot of word of mouth, but some of it has to be, I don't know, and I'm not on the DHS side, so I don't know how that word gets out, but that the fact that I have a community garden at a church needs to somehow get to that person who needs it. And where is that middle ground? And people know what that middle ground is. So it's a matter of connections.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's good to talk to you. We've exchanged lots of messages and it was fun to have a conversation longer, you know, and that's the thing. I being in public media, the tosses back and forth, we take forever to do it. You can, Ron, legendary Ron Steele, everybody's favorite. Hey, Eileen, what about this? You know, I mean, the tosses are, you know, you get six words, but Ron will go on and on and on.
And it's awesome. It's great because it teaches you, and especially with the tosses, and every person is different. So you have to learn how to respond. So it's like, okay, Ron, yes, as a matter of fact, this is how we do this, and then continue on. And then just keep talking because otherwise he will keep going. Yeah.
I know a meteorologist who hates it when you steal the thunder of what the forecast is. Oh, going to be hotter today. That's what I'm here to do,
not exactly.
You.
Yeah. Now, I'm not like that because that's a good toss because then I can go into the science of why it's going to be tough.
Well, and how many times can you sit there and watch the weather? Okay, not you, me. And you're like, you repeat the forecast three times, the beginning, the middle, and the end. And the consultants have told you all these crazy things about, you have to give us the forecast for right now, then the long range forecast, and now the next 7 days.
Yep.
And then you get done with that 3 minutes ago. Whoa. I forgot. What's it going to be tomorrow?
We get that a lot. Sometimes right after the show, it's like, wait a minute, what's the weather going to be like? Yeah. Is it going to rain today?
And those are the people in the control room.
Yes. Yeah. The people who should have been paying attention or giving you the time cues.
That's when they're busy on their phones or trying to get the sports scores that Rick is giving to them late.
Or dealing with the Rick's not there. Where's so and so live?
I guess I'm giving first names of people, but yes, I worked at KWWL as well years ago with some of these same people that you worked with, Eileen. And there's some great people. I do consider Ron one of the greatest people for young journalists to learn about the time to put in and the connection with people and the willingness to do whatever it took to get that story done. And you know, how many times I would hear my old professor Grant Price say, well, Ron would take, actually it was Liz Mathis, because Grant might not have known this story, but Liz would say, Ron would go shoot a fire right before 10 and it was like, it was 9:50 and he just would say, just have my script and coat and IFB at the chair. I'll be right there. And he'd usually throw the tape at somebody, run on at 9:50, 9:30
Yep.
And at 10 o'clock would say, good evening, Cedar Valley. It's time for the news.
Yeah. And there's still times now in the digital world where he is still working on a story that'll be later in the show during the show. So it's a little easier now with the digital world. So he doesn't have to be in the editing booth and doing the actual tape to tape.
Or just, I shouldn't say it because I'm a terrible planner, but you know, work a little bit further ahead, Ron. And not wait for the last minute. Why change things?
Because Eileen something's going to happen at the last second.
That's right. And you want it the most current as possible.
Exactly.
All right. Eileen, thank you so very much for the time.
Thanks, Paul.
My thanks to Eileen Lone for the guest time today on the M2M podcast, which is a production of Iowa PBS and the Market to Market TV show. Thanks for listening.